This is the Auto Tape Tour Glencoe, sponsored by the Celebrate Glencoe 12580 Committee. Please park in the east drive of the railroad station if you are not already there. You should move your car only as instructed in the course of the tape. In this way, you will be in front of the location being told about at that point in time. For everyone's safety, please use your emergency flasher lights all during the tour. This program is written and narrated by Roland Calhoun in the year 1994, 125 years after Glencoe's incorporation as a village. We start the tour at the railroad station, which is still the heart of the village, even as it was when the railroad first reached Glencoe in 1855. In the course of our time together, we'll cover some geography, some history, some personalities, and some topography. We want you to learn some things about your village which you otherwise might not know, or to hear more detail about them than you already have. The first non-Indian settler in Glencoe was Anson Taylor and family. He came here from Chicago in the year 1835, only 2 years after Chicago's own incorporation. Mr. Taylor felt that Chicago, with its population of 500 people, was getting too crowded. So he loaded his family and belongings aboard a barge and headed north along the shores of Lake Michigan. He bought a quarter section, that's 160 acres, of land from the U.S. government for just under $190 total, and established a log cabin home in the general area of what is now Sheridan Road and Woodlawn Avenue. Shortly thereafter, he was followed by a number of predominantly German farming families, as well as other English families bearing names such as Turnbull and Dietrich. They tended to farm on the north and west sides of the village. In the center of what is now Glencoe lived a man by the name of Matthew Coe. He lived in the area where now stands the castle, which is the building just north of the current Woman's Library Club. He ran a stock farm and orchard on 683 acres, which extended from the lake on the east to Bluff Street on the west, and from South Avenue to Beach and Dundee Roads on the north. This is slightly larger than a square mile. Matthew Coe was supplanted by his daughter and son-in-law, Walter Gurney, in 1853. They built the building known as the castle. Gurney was a native of Glencoe, Scotland, and it is believed that he so named the village. Theretofore, the community centered around Anson Taylor's Inn and was known as Taylor's Port. The inn itself was called La Pier House. Walter Gurney was the president of the Chicago and Milwaukee Railroad, as it was then called, when it was built through Glencoe to Little Fort, now Waukegan, in 1855. Since rank has its privilege, Gurney decreed that the station be placed at the Park Avenue location, ignoring the Taylor's Port settlement in the Harbor Street Woodlawn area. In 1869, the Glencoe Company was formed. 2 years earlier, Walter Gurney had sold his 683-acre stock farm to Dr. Alexander Hammond. Dr. Hammond was a man with visions and ideals. He formed the Glencoe Company of 10 men who came together to plan and found a community which would be a most attractive place in which to live. Some of them were real estate developers. Others were businessmen of goodwill who wanted a nice place for their families to live. These men agreed that they would each build a home to live in plus another to sell. Further, they each pledged $100 per year for a minister, and $50 per year to pay a schoolteacher. The parkland at the foot of Park Avenue at the lake was set aside by these men as a park at that time. Commitment of a more prosaic kind was made for road construction. What we need to carry away from all this is that Glencoe started as a planned community. As the twig was bent, so has the tree grown. So, in 1869, the village of Glencoe was incorporated. However, the financial panic of 1871 intervened, putting some of the men out of the picture entirely and slowing down others. Nevertheless, on this tour, we will see still standing some of the houses built by the men of the original Glencoe Company. We noted earlier that the railroad came to Glencoe in 1855. The village was then as it is now primarily a commuter community. The present depot building was dedicated in 1891 and rebuilt and upgraded in 1991. The railroad in Glencoe tends to be a dividing line for a number of things. You will notice that there is no commercial enterprise on the east side of the railroad tracks. It was the desire of the early founders that this should be so, as they considered the east side to be the more preferable one in which to live. Also, by virtue of the railroad tracks having been built on the highest ground, they are the demarcation of a mini-continental divide. Now, we all know that the continental divide is where rainfall on one side drains to the Pacific Ocean, while the other side drains off to the Atlantic. But in the case of our mini-continental divide, rainfall east of the tracks runs off into the lake and eventually out the St. Lawrence River into the Atlantic. However, rainfall on the west side drains into the Skokie Lagoons, which are the east fork of the north branch of the Chicago River. Due to the Chicago River having its flow reversed early in this century, that water now travels the Illinois and Mississippi rivers into the Gulf of Mexico. Originally, the mini-continental divide was in Northbrook, running north-south somewhere between Finkston and Landwehr Roads. At the time, it was a case of water draining either into the Chicago or the Des Plaines River. So here in Glencoe, all unheralded, we have a mini-continental divide right in the heart of town. We have records from the year 1883 about the railroad and its service to Chicago. Making three more stops than present day, the trip was accomplished in 50 minutes. Now, 110 years later, through science and technology, and making three fewer stops, they have managed to cut the time by a whole 7 minutes. So much for progress on the rails. Now, we will start our drive by pulling up at Cauk Park, heading east on Park Avenue, and there we'll pause and talk about some of the things we see. To the north, we see Veterans Memorial Park. Established in the aftermath of World War I, it has long been the scene of our Memorial Day tributes to Glencoe's fallen war dead. In 1985, an Eagle Scout by the name of Kevin McGuire took on the major project of seeing to the upgrading of the location with a new flagpole, contouring, landscaping, and including memorial stones for the wars since World War I. To this end, over $12,000 was raised from community organizations and individuals. The park on the south is named for Henry Cauk, who retired from the park district as superintendent after spending over 40 years serving Glencoe in a variety of park needs and services. In the 1930s, this park was the site of Glencoe's only skating rink, over which Henry Cauk then presided as ice maker, stove stoker, and corrector of child behavior. The gazebo in the center of the park has been erected in the memory of Liza Bates McLeod, a Glencoe schoolgirl who died of leukemia in 1989. Once again, Glencoe opened its hearts and pocketbooks, contributing over $35,000 to provide the living memorial known as Liza's gazebo. As focal point of the park, it is used for concerts and other community events. Again on the north, we have the Glencoe Union Church. It stands on the site of the original Glencoe Congregational Church, created by the Glencoe Company, and for whose minister they pledged the total of $1,000 per year. The original church burned down in 1910, with the current church being dedicated in 1912. Its then-minister, Dr. Douglas Cornell, urged the congregation to rename it the Glencoe Union Church and declare it to be an interdenominational Protestant church. Further, the new church included a community center room in its basement, which provided a venue for sports, plays, magic lantern shows, and later movies. Also in the basement were two bowling alleys, Glencoe's first and only. And to that basement room, Dr. Cornell brought the first Boy Scout troop west of the Allegheny Mountains and the North Shore's first drama group, the Threshold Players, which persisted some 50 years within the village. Now let's start the car and proceed east to Greenleaf Avenue, where we will make a right turn. Greenleaf Avenue is the locus of a preponderance of the older, significant, larger houses in Glencoe. We learned earlier that this was thought to be on the better side of town. Now please stop on the right, facing south, across from the Methodist Church. This puts you at the corner of Greenleaf and Hazel. Besides being on the non-commercial side of the railroad, it was further from the Skokie Marsh, which bred and supplied Glencoe with copious amounts of mosquitoes prior to the establishment of the North Shore Mosquito Abatement District, one of those little arcane entries on your real estate tax bill. The east side was also closer to the lake for its cooling summer breezes and tempering of winter's cold. And until the park district was formed in 1912, Glencoe's only park was the lakefront one created at the time of the 1869 incorporation. In addition, because people were walking to the railroad station, walking to the grocery store, meat market, post office, school, shoe store, and church, then as now, location was everything in real estate. Saddling a horse or hitching up a buggy was neither easily nor quickly accomplished. Walking with a wagon for children and groceries was the simpler mode. On the east side, we see the North Shore United Methodist Church. This church was constituted in the year 1910, and for its first 5 years, services were held in the then Woman's Library Club structure, which we behold today as a private residence on the northwest corner of Hazel and Greenleaf. The Methodist Church building, which we see today, had its core structure completed in 1915. The building on the northwest corner opened as the Woman's Library Club in the year 1906. The club itself had started in 1874 by women of Glencoe. Until the creation of the Glencoe Library, it served the role of repository of books for general Glencoe usage, along with the library of the Congregational Church. The Glencoe Public Library was at this location from 1919 until moving to its present structure in 1941. We now proceed slowly past Hazel Avenue to view some of the houses. 615 Greenleaf Avenue is the house once owned by a General Howard of significant Civil War service. He was Glencoe's Civil War hero. Also on the east side is 599 Greenleaf Avenue. It was in this house that Dr. Samuel Bartlett lived as the pastor of the Congregational Church from its inception until he left in 1877 to become the president of Dartmouth College. The exterior was remodeled in 1904. In its basement is a cistern to accumulate rainwater for clothes washing purposes. You see, rainwater was considered soft, whereas water pumped from the well was known to be hard. Note it still has its barn, as did any house of significance in the 1800s. This property originally ran to Hawthorne Avenue and east to Sheridan Road, not an unusual size in its day. The house was purchased in 1883 by Samuel Herford, a Chicago attorney who first arrived in Glencoe in 1871. He boarded with the Dr. Starr family while commuting to the city. He was active in the affairs of the village, as was the uniform custom of the day. Less typical was his wife Jenny, who was a founder of the Woman's Library Club in 1874, and who served on the first school board when the district was established in 1896. It would seem that the women kept busy, caring for their families and doing good works. Most homes employed a maid for cooking and housekeeping, plus often a gardener hired man for the heavy outside work and to care for the horses and other livestock. The two houses on the southeast corner of Greenleaf and Hawthorne are built on ravine property which was filled in during the late 1940s to allow their construction, an action which would likely find much resistance today. Now turn right on Hawthorne Avenue, westbound up the hill. On the right, in the middle of the block on the north side, stood the home of Dr. John Starr, just moved to Vernon Avenue in the year 1994 to preserve it. While Dr. Starr was an original member of the Glencoe Company, this house of Dr. Starr's was his second. It was built in the mid-70s and on the east of his original house, which of course is no longer standing. Let's turn left to the south on Old Green Bay Road and stop promptly. Here on the east side, numbered 557 and 535, are two very similar-looking houses built by Charles E. Brown, an original Glencoe Company member. They have been variously remodeled since. As we pause in front of these houses, let us realize that this street was, until the mid-30s, the principal north-south route between the North Shore villages. The road on the west side of the tracks, then known as Railroad Avenue, ran from the south only as far north as Temple Court, there stymied by the depression of Hazel Avenue. The latter was earlier constructed to preclude fire equipment from being blocked from the east side by a slow-moving freight train. The railroad ran all its freight trains through the North Shore route until a bypass for freights was built early in the century through East Northbrook and other Skokie Valley communities. That freight route exists today. Those driving Dundee Road can experience the type of waits that the Hazel Underpass was constructed to do away with. Before we move on to the south, take another look at these two houses. They look like twins, which they once were. Throughout this tour, we'll be pointing out other sets of twin houses, built to identical floor plans or mirror images thereof. Rather than fill an entire tract with houses of the same plan, it appears that much of Glencoe was developed in bite-sized construction, more frequently by independent entrepreneurs seeking some economy on a small scale indeed. It's fun to seek them out as one drives about the village, once sensitized to the possibility. Back in the early days, lots were considerably larger, only to be subsequently subdivided for a variety of financial or other reasons. Let's pull up to South Avenue now and stop for a moment. As we drive throughout the village, you'll be seeing various parcels of park property, often seemingly at random. The park district was founded in 1912, which was prior to our adopting a zoning code. Some of the village fathers used condemnation of property for parks as a zoning tool. Before moving on, we should remember that here, just east of the Northwestern Railway right-of-way, ran another railroad for a number of years. It started in 1898. The North Shore Railroad supplied electric interurban service through Glencoe until its abandonment in 1963. The trains, a string of glorified streetcars, provided excellent local service with many more stops than the Northwestern along the North Shore. From Maple Hill Road on the north to this South Avenue location, their right-of-way was alongside Green Bay Road on the dedicated street property, but not on the pavement. At either end of the village, the railroad owned the property. In the late 60s, the village bought that right-of-way and established the Green Bay Trail as we know it today. The local trains stopped at Maple Hill, called Green Bay Road Station, Park Avenue, here at South Avenue, Harbor Street, and at Woodlawn Avenue. Five stops in all to the Northwestern's one in Glencoe. They also ran a special train from Maple Hill Crossing to Indian Hill every school day for the exclusive use of New Trier students. In 1938, the charge was 5 cents each way, and the train was 4 cars long. In Wilmette, the North Shore Line connected at Linden Avenue to the tracks of what is now known as the CTA, running into Chicago and around the loop on their tracks. Now we start back up, turning left to go east on South Avenue. At the corner of Greenleaf Avenue, let's pause again. As a boy, it troubled me that South Avenue was pretty much in the middle of the community. Only later did we learn that it was, at the time, the south limit of the stock farm, which became the first of the village corporate limits. This fairly causes one to question, where is the harbor of Harbor Street? Here we learn that there was a logging industry at Harbor Street, and the railroad was served by this in early days. Wood was cut to supply the railroad's wood-burning engines. It was also burned in pits to reduce it to charcoal, a fuel then used for cooking and industrial purposes in the city. The charcoal was taken to a pier which extended at the foot of Harbor Street for shipment to Chicago. The pier was Glencoe's harbor, and the practice continued into the 1870s. Now, while we're still paused at Greenleaf Avenue, let's take a moment to look at the large white house on the northeast corner. With a house to the east, which was once the coach house, and a house to the north, which is a remodeled servants' quarters, we see how extensive some of the early estates of the village were. This dates from 1920. We now turn left on Greenleaf Avenue in a northerly direction, where we find a number of the larger, more gracious older homes which were built in Glencoe. As always, tastes vary, but here is a block with a smorgasbord of handsome homes in what early on in the history of our village was considered a very choice area. On our left, set well back, is a large brick house, number 520. In the mid-1930s, there was a flurry of excitement when Amelia Earhart, the famous aviatrix, was for a while visiting the family which lived there. She was at the height of her fame at the time, and it was a period of heroes and heroines such as Lindbergh and herself. We will now turn right on Hawthorne Avenue, proceeding east across Sheridan Road, where we will again pause. The second and third houses east of Sheridan Road are mirror image twins, followed immediately to the east by the brick twins. The last house on the north side at Longwood Avenue has its twin at 794 Greenwood Avenue. Let's turn left on Longwood and pull over for a moment. Having just crossed Sheridan Road, we'll now talk about it. It was originally called Linwood Avenue on the plat of incorporation, and it didn't go through to the north. In the 1880s, there occurred a riot in Chicago known as the Haymarket Riot. It was particularly bloody. Fearing anarchy and a spread of such rioting, major figures living in Lake Forest, such as Armour and Swift, persuaded the federal government to establish a military base which would also serve to buffer their homes from any further possible unpleasantness. Fort Sheridan was the result, bringing into being the access road leading to it, now called Sheridan Road. Because of the number of ravines requiring bridging, the original Green Bay Road lay west of the ravine beginnings in Glencoe and Highland Park. Longwood Avenue came to be prized, of course, for the lake frontage which the homes on the east side enjoy. Here you will see that homes have been built, generally behind the original homes, in order to subdivide the lots, thus reducing taxes while generating a return on the investment. These have all been done in such a way that both homes can enjoy the proximity of the lake, either through vista or access. A good example of that is found at 587 and 585 Longwood. As we approach Hazel Avenue, we want to talk about Lakefront Park, so let's cross Hazel and pull over on the right. Lakefront Park came into being with the original platting of the village incorporation in 1869, in accordance with the plans of the original incorporators. Not only was it Glencoe's first park, but it remained its only park until the creation of the park district in 1912. As such, it was the locus of virtually all the outdoor special events of the village, particularly the 4th of July celebration. Now let's proceed north to Park Avenue and turn east toward the lake and park there for a few moments. Glencoe's water came from wells until 1893, when a water distribution system was installed to serve the village with water purchased from Winnetka. This persisted until 1928, when the waterworks at the foot of Park Avenue was opened. Its construction occasioned the building of Glencoe's only railway running east and west. In order to get building supplies down the bluff to the construction site, a cable railway was constructed, running just south of the existing staircase at the foot of Park Avenue. It ran straight down to the beach level with a spur running north at the level of the existing service drive. Small mine-type cars were hooked onto a cable at the top of the bluff, which in turn was powered by an electric motor. All the machinery was encased in a control house of the same architecture as the other beach structures. The railway continued to operate well into the 30s, delivering water treatment supplies from trucks down the bluff to the waterworks. The bathhouse, halfway house, and access ramps and stairs were built in the late 20s also. The amount of sand was much smaller in the beach area at that time, so a pier was rebuilt to catch and hold sand as the lake brought it down from the north in the course of its usual pattern. When the bathhouse was completed around 1930, 13 steps led from its terrace down to the beach level. Today, all but two of the steps have been covered with a sand buildup, which now extends nearly to the end of the pier. During the 30s, the swimming area featured two rafts plus a two-level diving tower set out beyond the second raft in about 12 feet of water. Being capable of swimming out to the diving tower was a milestone much to be desired among the youth of the village at that time. The tennis courts in the park were built in the 1960s when the storage capacity of Glencoe's water tower on Skokie Boulevard was deemed too small to match the expanded capacity of the waterworks. Thus, a large storage tank was installed under Lakefront Park, and the tennis courts placed on the top of the concrete roof of the tank. We were then selling water to Northbrook, even as we had once bought our water from Winnetka. Now let's start up and head back west to Sheridan Road, where we'll turn north. But on the way, let us pause for a moment in front of 126 Park Avenue, a small Mediterranean-style house on the south side. In the 1930s, a spinster by the name of Bertha Meckstroth lived in this house. While at Radcliffe College, Miss Meckstroth had been the roommate of the well-known blind, deaf-mute lady Helen Keller. Miss Meckstroth was very accommodating to high school students who found themselves assigned to book reports and other studies of Helen Keller's life. Miss Meckstroth spent much of her time making tapestries, which she then donated to Radcliffe College to be used in fundraisers. The tapestries are well known in those circles to this day. We now turn right on Sheridan Road and go one block north to Beach Road, where we pause. Here we remind ourselves that this was the northern limit of the original incorporated village. Beyond this point was the area known as Newhall's Woods. Franklin Newhall, also called Grandpa Newhall, lived in the house which still stands on the southeast corner of Beach Road and Greenleaf Avenue. He owned a great deal of property north and east of there at the time of incorporation, but chose not to be one of the Glencoe Company. Now let's start moving slowly northward. In his time, the two sons grew up and married, building two houses across Sheridan Road from each other, bearing the numbers 780 and what would probably be 775, but at this moment is unmarked. And we pause. As was the case with a number of families, the Newhall family went north to vacation homes in Wisconsin for the summer, with the men commuting back to work, a part of the time, in Chicago by rail. The story goes that their wives both complained to their husbands that the other wife had the nicer home, and expressed great discontent over this belief. At the conclusion of one summer, the Newhall brothers had had enough of this and took action. While the wives and families were in Wisconsin, the Newhall brothers simply switched the entire contents of the two houses across the street into the house of the other. Upon the wives' return from Wisconsin, they were ushered into the other house and told to cease their complaining. The story is that they did. A little further north, we see on the west side house number 790. While it is often attributed to Frank Lloyd Wright, it is only of his Prairie School of Architecture. But not to worry, an authentic Frank Lloyd Wright house is just ahead on the west side at number 850, just on the ravine. This seeming one-story house has a lower living level on the ravine side, best seen in winter when the leaves and vegetation don't impair the view, and best seen probably as a pedestrian on the west side of the bridge. It is one of about nine houses in Glencoe attributed either to Wright or his staff. As we cross another of the ravine bridges, this one at Maple Hill Road, let's pause and think a moment. We are reminded that these ravines were caused by Glencoe having literally been formed by a glacier. The glacier pushed south through Glencoe as far south as two blocks beyond Tower Road to Christ Church on the east side of town. It extended further south on the west side of Winnetka, evidenced by the ridge at Country Day School, Indian Hill Country Club, and along the appropriately named Ridge Road into West Wilmette and Skokie. The drop-off on Sheridan Road at Christ Church speaks clearly of the limit of the glacier, known as the Highland Park Moraine. A moraine being the ridge of higher land left by a glacier as it receded through the process of gradual melting. In moving south, the glacier originally plowed up and carried along with it a great deal of rock and earth. When the glacier melted, the waters to the east ran off very strongly, and in so doing carved out the ravines which we have today. That no rains, however extraordinary, could have carved them is evidenced by the fact that their beds remain largely unchanged over 150 years of such rains. The ravines do continue to drain rainfall east of the tracks into Lake Michigan. As a result of the ravines having been formed long ago, Old Green Bay Road, which was once an Indian trail, skirts to the west of their points of origin. In this way, the trail stays as close to the lake as possible without having to actually cross ravines. It was a nuisance that the Indians didn't want to put up with, and in early days, it was also an expenditure that city fathers didn't see fit to make for the requisite bridges. Let's start slowly northward again at this time, leaving the flashers on. The area of North Sheridan Road on the east side had even larger estates than those on Longwood Avenue, albeit built later in time. Virtually all of these pieces of property have been subdivided to an extent, but often one can find the original manor house among some of the later entries. We are now passing Franklin Road and going over another Sheridan Road bridge. Sheridan Road was named for General Phil Sheridan and his namesake fort, just north of Highwood. We proceed north now to find ourselves at the North Shore Congregation Israel. This is the current home of the Jewish congregation, which built its first edifice in Glencoe in 1927 on Vernon Avenue. This earlier building is now a part of Am Shalom's temple at that site. The congregation itself was founded in 1920, meeting during the intervening years in other venues, including the Winnetka Women's Club. Faced with an expanding congregation, North Shore first thought of expanding at the old site on Vernon Avenue, but then determined that this land would be available. The building was designed by a Japanese architect by the name of Minoru Yamasaki and was built in the 1960s and since expanded. To the north of North Shore Congregation Israel is Lakeshore Country Club, a Jewish country club which was founded in Glencoe in 1908. Originally, the clubhouse contained residence rooms where persons could move out from the city to live while utilizing the club during the summer months. These rooms exist to this day. In their earlier days, the country clubs in Glencoe found members building cottages in proximity to the clubs, so members' families could also repair to the suburb for the summer, though residing in Chicago. Some of these cottages, now remodeled into year-round residences, can still be found along Grove Street and Washington Avenue. Now we'll proceed north and bend west on Sheridan Road as it becomes briefly a part of Lake Cook or County Line Road. As we travel, it is worth reflecting that Glencoe is bounded by a great deal of open space. Besides the obvious lake on the east, it has two golf courses plus forest preserves on the north, and forest preserve property in the form of the Botanic Garden and Skokie Lagoons on the west. It is only on our south border that we have a continuum of housing units. As we travel west, we find ourselves temporarily in Highland Park and Lake County, even as the eastbound traffic passing us is in Glencoe and Cook County. Continuing west at the traffic light, we proceed two short blocks farther, stopping on the shoulder at the north side in front of a small fenced cemetery. Although physically in Highland Park, this is truly Glencoe's first cemetery. The original owners in this area were an English family by the name of Robert Daggett. They had 9 children. The sudden deaths of 2 of their daughters, followed by the death of their 17-year-old son by a falling tree, caused the creation of this plot as a cemetery by the Daggetts. As much of the land in this area was settled by English and German farmers, this became their final resting place. Inside you will find a number of headstones in German language, clearly bespeaking their heritage. It's interesting to note here that the Lutheran Church in Glencoe until the 1950s conducted 1 German language worship service each Sunday for the descendants for whom German was still their principal tongue. For many years, there was no place within the city limits of Glencoe where one could be interred, this cemetery being the closest thing to it. Then, in the 1970s, the Glencoe Union Church established a non-sectarian memorial garden for the interment of ashes. No longer did death preclude citizens from remaining in Glencoe. We see the Forest Preserve on our left as we cross the railroad tracks now at the station known as Brayside. The Forest Preserve District is a governmental body of Cook County and was established, as the name suggests, to preserve forest land, generally river bottom and stream bed land unsuitable for farming, and they preserved it in perpetuity. While some of it is clearly suitable for subdividing and developing, we are fortunate that the Forest Preserve District got there first. A modern-day counterpart would be the Nature Conservancy, although it uses private funds rather than public. And it is a fact that in their acquisition days, the Forest Preserve District was acquiring land of then little value at commensurately low cost. We now proceed west to Green Bay Road, where we turn left and go south. We have Turnbull Woods for this part of the preserve, named for the Turnbull family, who originally farmed in this area. On the east side, just before the meadow, we see a small knoll with a group of white pine trees. This marks the location of the Turnbull farmhouse. While the white pine is the state tree of Illinois, it proved so useful for building and furniture construction that most of the trees are no longer to be seen. We are now coming up on Wesley Road and will turn right there where the sign says Glencoe Golf Club. This club is administered by the Village Board of Glencoe and is jointly owned by Glencoe and the Forest Preserve District. The front nine holes and principal buildings are on Forest Preserve property, while the back nine is owned by the village. This latter property was originally bought by the village as the site of a future landfill when there were no houses in the vicinity. Instead, Glencoe built an incinerator out on Skokie Boulevard under the water tower, doing away with the immediate landfill need. This was back in the 20s. The golf course was the result as Glencoe joined forces with the Forest Preserve District to create a public fee course and create Glencoe's third 18-hole golf course in a village whose population then ran about 6,000. That was probably a record ratio in its day. Now the Forest Preserve District, as senior partner in the undertaking, decreed that any profits resulting from the course operation were to flow back to them. But the village was left to run the course, and the result was that, rather than create profits to be expatriated to Cook County, the course was simply outstandingly maintained and ran at no profit as a result. As you drive into the facility and go by the clubhouse on the west, you will see at its heart the farmhouse which served the farm from which this course has sprung. Let's pause in the turning loop facing west now